Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I love reading bad reviews. They're way more entertaining than good reviews, even if I'm on the receiving end. I did a series of concerts in Frankfurt, Germany back in the 90s. One of them was a show with John Laurie, the sax player and founder of the Lounge Lizards, hugely popular in Europe, and the concert was mobbed. John played solo, we spoke on stage, and the next day the review came out. And most of it was focused, properly, on John Laurie. But the reviewer did spare a moment to review my interview, although he used a word I wasn't familiar with. Schnodderiges. Not a very pretty sounding word, is it? Anyway, I looked it up and it turns out schnodderiges means snotty. The Frankfurter Allgemeine, one of the most respected newspapers in Europe, had called me snotty. I actually thought that was pretty cool. A few years ago, I remember reading a New York Times review of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker. It was a New York City ballet production, so, you know, nothing wildly unusual. And I really don't remember anything from that review, except for this line. Jennifer Ringer, as the sugar plum fairy, looked as if she'd eaten one sugar plum too many. Now that is a line I'll never forget. Neither will Jennifer Ringer, who discusses her longtime struggle with body image, her years at the very pinnacle of American ballet, and Sugar Plum Gate in her new memoir. She'll join us later. We'll also have live music from Parker Millsap, who sounds like a grizzled veteran of the Americana scene, but who in fact is just about to turn 21. But first, I wanna go back to my little grass shack, to Kealakekua, Hawaii. Ukulele. Maybe the sound makes you think of the beach at Maui, or maybe it just reminds you of Elvis's schlockier moments. The tiny four-stringed instrument has made recent appearances in How I Met Your Mother and the film Her, and divided internet commenters across the land. So it is time to answer the question, is the ukulele a charming, portable composer's dream, or a twee novelty whose time has passed? It's a topic for today's
Soundcheck Smackdown!
And joining me today in the Smackdown ring is Jesse David Fox. He is associate editor for New York Magazine's Vulture blog, and Ben Greenman, contributing editor at The New Yorker. To the two of you, welcome to the Smackdown.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, John.
Jesse, you recently wrote a piece for New York Magazine called In Defense of the Ukulele, which our listeners can find at soundcheck.org. Why did you feel compelled to write this essay?
It mostly came out of a How I Met Your Mother episode where it ended with the mother playing the ukulele in this beautiful scene. And then the next day, I wanted to read other people talk about how much they loved it. And then some people did like it, but a lot of people were like, oh, it's so twee, it's so cliche that she did that. And I was like, I feel like there needs to be someone defending it to those people specifically.
Ben, were you one of those people hating on How I Met Your Mother's ukulele finale?
I didn't actively comment on it, but I did. And I read Jesse's piece, which everyone should read. And it does actually a great job of laying out the anti-ukulele argument and then dismantling it. I mean, he's okay, in the sense that he's fair about accommodating and explaining the anti-ukulele. He doesn't just charge right in and assume that you should love the ukulele. He explains why people don't like it. And so I sadly remain on the side of the line before the argument was dismantled.
All right. I want to play Israel Kamakawiwoole, the Hawaiian musician who famously back in 1999 recorded a version of Over the Rainbow, beautiful singing, accompanied only by the ukulele. Listen.
Over the rainbow, bluebirds fly, and the dreams that of the chimney top, that's where you find me, oh, somewhere over.
That is some music from the birthplace of the ukulele, from Hawaii. That is Israel Kamakawiwa Ole and his version of Over the Rainbow. And now, Jesse, this is 1999. This is kind of, this version of Over the Rainbow is a kind of pivotal moment in recent ukulele.
I'd say so. And I think it's actually recorded earlier in the 90s, but in 1999 it started being used in commercials. And somehow that was how it came out. And I think it just kind of reintroduced it and especially put it back into terms of a Hawaiian instrument, because late in the 60s it started to be seen as a novelty and kind of a joke instrument. And as I put in the piece, it was also the same time where the Magnetic Fields 69 Love Songs came out, which also kind of, like, I think, created the base of when it became like an object that indie artists started using, or it's also kind of around the time where, like, the hipster subculture started really germinating. So it's like this one time period really both together, and I think worked for it.
And Ben, for you, listening back to this recording from, you know, more than 15 years ago, what's wrong with that?
Well, that's a Hawaiian music artifact, so there's nothing wrong with it. I don't think you can take the ukulele out of Hawaiian music, certainly. My issue is that if you go even earlier, back to George Harrison, say, who's a famous ukulele proponent, or Pete Townsend, who used it, it seemed to be this sort of portable demo instrument that rockers carried around with them and to use to compose, to practice. It's small, it's easy to carry. It's like the iPhone of instruments. And they can decorate it, they can make it. And my problem with it is that it may be fine for them, but for audiences, it has a kind of, it needs to be liked too much. It's like looking at someone else's children and being asked to appreciate them. I understand why they like it. I just don't have to like it as much as they do. It's hard to imagine Pete Townsend going out and smashing the ukulele.
Right. Now, in an email to us when we were setting this up, you referred to the ukulele as the goatee of musical instruments. What does that mean?
I've alternately decided that it's the cat photo of musical instruments, because it's two things. It's, Jesse mentioned, the hipster component, and it has a kind of collectible feel to it. I mean, it almost is, you know, people can carry it around and show it to you when they meet you in the bar. I brought my ukulele with me. And it's the cat photo because it has this currency online where nearly every song you can think of in the history of pop music, someone will go and do a ukulele cover version of it. And some of them go viral. There's ukulele, Get Lucky Ukulele, Blurred Lines, Ukulele Umbrella. While a terrible musical idea, a good idea for an invention, I think, probably. But it's it has that viral, it's a collectible, look at me, like me feel to it.
Let's hear a little bit of the Blurred Lines ukulele cover, which has gone viral online.
I know you want it, you're a good girl. Can't let you pass it, you're far from plastic. Talk about getting blasted, hate these blurred lines. I know you want it, I know you want it. I know you want it, you're a good girl. The way you grab it, my swan get nasty. Go on, get at me. Hottest bitch in this place, I feel so lucky. You wanna hug me? What rhymes with hug me?
Well, now even Ben is laughing here in the studio. Although Ben might be laughing at Jordan D. White's cover of Blurred Lines, whereas I think Jesse is laughing with young Jordan.
It's hard to say. I acknowledge that is comic, and it's possible that that was the point, and I think that does get to some of the ukulele's history of since, like, I think it's like 1968, where Tiny Tim had that the novelty hit playing Tiptoe Through the Tulips. There is a somewhat a comic nature to the instrument, and I think hopefully this guy was tapping into that.
So when we talked before about the Over the Rainbow cover as a kind of pivotal moment, going back, there was an earlier pivotal moment where the pivot went in the wrong direction.
And it became kind of out of favor for a long while as kind of a result of that, because no one really wanted to play something that was seen so as a novelty or as a joke. And I think maybe there's still some of that in the playing with it. And I think, you know, Arrested Development had it, and Bob's right. Burgers theme song has ukulele.
So but, you know, everything gets rediscovered and recontextualized. And there are lots of people, you know, going back to the 80s who were already saying, you know, Tiny Tim was like a really good musician.
Yeah.
And, you know, you might have thought it was a joke, but maybe he didn't intend it that way. Let's listen. Tiptoe Through the Tulips. We are smacking around the ukulele. Jesse David Fox, associate editor for New York Magazine's Vulture blog, writing his article In Defense of the Ukulele, which you can find at soundcheck.org. And Ben Greenman, contributing editor at The New Yorker, smacking the little four-string instrument around here in the Soundcheck studio. Listeners, what do you think? Leave a comment at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Ben, why do we need to quote you again, cast off the yoke of the uke?
Well, I think that I'd like to ask or raise the Eddie Vedder example as well, which follows sort of closely on the heels of George Harrison's, which is that rock and roll becomes this overpowering, maybe too bloviating large, too powerful a force. And they go back to the smaller four-stringed instrument as a way of recovering something essential. Again, my argument would be, great for them. I don't necessarily need to participate in that experiment that happens behind closed doors.
So you don't have a problem with, say, a mandolin or, you know, any other small acoustic string instrument? It's the ukulele?
My desire to burn it varies depending on the instrument. And as Jesse mentioned before in his piece, it's the culture of the ukulele. It's hard to pull out the sound of the instrument and attack the sound of it. It's the things around it, the indie rock pretensions, the tweeness, as he said, the, you know, the smallness of it, the pocketness of it.
I think he agrees it can sound nice. It is still an instrument.
You mentioned before the Magnetic Field, Stephen Merritt and his band, mm-hmm. and their album 69 Love Songs, where one of the best love songs, and there really were 69 of them, was a 3-CD set. The song Book of Love, it's hard to imagine this song played on any other instrument other than this kind of like homemade ukulele that Stephen made.
Well, I think he has a quote in a New York Times article where something where he says it sounds untrained. There's a certain – it's just like when you have a vocal like his, which is also kind of untrained, there's a nice harmony there where it kind of – it gives it, even if it's like a DIY almost aesthetic, mm-hmm. because it is – not as perfect as like a guitar would be.
Let's hear Stephen Merritt recording as Magnetic Fields in his song Book of Love.
The Book of Love is long and boring. No one can lift the damn thing. It's full of charts and facts and figures and instructions for dancing, but I love it when you read to me and you can read me anything.
Ben Greenman, if we weren't doing a Soundcheck Smackdown about the ukulele right now, would you have recognized that as a ukulele?
I think that's a good question. I, in listening to it now with that in mind, I think it could be a guitar in theory, treated. I understand that it is a ukulele. I've been told 45 seconds ago that it was. But I think Jesse's point is actually a good point, which is that it's sort of the white equivalent of, there's blues instruments that people will go and make where they'll make a guitar out of their porch, and they'll nail a guitar string on one side and on
a
the
diddly
other
bow,
side. Right? Mm-hmm. A diddly bow, or even there's much stranger variations on that. You know, shoebox guitars, those right. kinds of things. Prior to the show, you were mentioning that it goes out of tune very easily, and it has that kind of homemade feel to it. Again, this just feeds right back into my argument, which is good for you, bad for me.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't good for me either, struggling to get this. It seems like such a simple instrument. Four strings, tune it up, play your song. As soon as you finish tuning the fourth string, the first one's out of tune again.
And I think if you get, like, very nice ukuleles, it's probably less of a problem. And
Who gets very nice ukuleles?
Well, I know. That's saying Kirsten Milioti, who is the mother in How I Met Your Mother, saying that she plays still the same ukulele that her dad gave her 20 years ago. And there is something to, like, if you're going to play ukulele, you want to play a bad ukulele, or like a not as good ukulele?
It's a photo. It's a photo album instrument. It's the one that gets passed down that you found in the attic. Eddie Vedder probably has a nice one.
Yeah.
So now Ben was mentioning before the scene in The Jerk where Bernadette Peters and Steve Martin are walking on the beach, and you know the ukulele, Jesse, is part and parcel of this scene. So Ben's using it to make his case. I suppose you could use this same scene to make your case.
Yes, and it is. I mean, I think I wrote in the piece. I think it's my favorite scene in movie history, and I think it's because one, there's still kind of a niceness to it. And if that scene came today, a contemporary comedian was like playing that same scene, I think it would be seen pretty negatively in that same way, where it's like, oh, it's so cliche, it's so all this. But like that scene itself, I think even Ben agreed. Like you watch it, especially in the context of the movie. It's just like a really enjoyable.
I'm not
scene.
Sure Ben will agree, but let's hear the scene.
Way down by the stream, how sweet it will seem once more just to dream in the moonlight. My honey ain't nowhere with the dawn.
So it's this lovely moonlit walk with this intimate little instrument between them, and suddenly the trumpet comes blatting and blaring in. Were they kind of sending up their own scene, do you think?
I mean, I think they're like playing to the fact like this is a movie where things like this happen, where it's like, and I think there's some self-parody to it, but they don't not have the moment.
Yeah.
And Steve Martin obviously has gone on to show us all that he takes his music very seriously. He plays the banjo, he plays bluegrass very seriously. So I don't think it's utterly a parody. I think Jesse's piece does another interesting thing, which is that he talks about the gendering of the ukulele and men playing it and women playing it. If it's the goatee for men, I think there's a degree to which, because of people like Zooey Deschanel, it's the vintage dress that verges on looking like a costume of instruments when women play it. And there is that old-timey borrowed antiqueness, the automatic vintage feel, which sometimes isn't earned. It seems like people are loading that into the music because it feels old-timey without needing to earn it in any way.
So the ukulele is shorthand for something.
Oh, it's definitely shorthand for a lot of things. I think that's true. And maybe the guitar is also, but it's so mainstream that maybe it isn't anymore. The ukulele is. It means certain specific things.
Jesse, is there any extent to which you're beginning to think, okay, maybe enough with the ukulele?
Well, I think that cover that he played earlier had some to it, where because it's an easy instrument to play, everyone can play it, which is great because everyone can play it, but it's also bad because everyone can play it. So you want people to be able to play instruments. I think we all think that's probably a beneficial thing. But then when it's on YouTube and like, no one's forcing you to watch this cover, but it's close to it.
But if you've paid your $12, $15 to see her, you will be forced to listen to a ukulele.
And I think I point out, it's like the ukulele, if it's in just kind of part of a hipster culture thing, this is a movie nominated for Best Picture. And How I Met Your Mother is a major network sitcom. Zooey Deschanel is on a major network sitcom. So it is exposing an aesthetic that maybe wasn't that mainstream to like the most mainstream of sensibilities. And her is, an example that I love that I learned that other people apparently did not.
Read all about it in Jesse's article, In Defense of the Ukulele. Jesse David Fox is associate editor for New York Magazine's Vulture blog. Ben Greenman is not so sanguine about the possibilities, the cultural possibilities of the ukulele. He is a contributing editor at The New Yorker. This has been our Soundcheck Smackdown about the ukulele. Jesse, Ben, thank you guys.
Thank
it's been a lot
me.
Of fun.
Thank you, John.
It's a dark and shiny place, but with you, my dear, I'm safe and we're a million miles away.
Up next, the Oklahoma-bred singer-songwriter Parker Millsap brings his brand of folk, gospel, and country to our studio. And later, a new memoir chronicles the story of one dancer for the New York City Ballet, including a brush with tabloids and the Today Show. Jennifer Ringer joins us to talk about her book, Dancing Through It. This is Soundcheck.
Alice, full of malice, got kicked out of her own palace.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. On his website, Parker Millsap's bio reads as follows. Quote, Parker was born. He now sings and writes songs, unquote. And that's it. We hope we can get the Oklahoma singer-songwriter to be a little more forthcoming when we talk to him in just a bit, but first, Parker and his band are going to play a song for us off of Parker Millsap's self-titled album that came out earlier this year. The song is called Disappear. It's Parker Millsap and his band live on Soundcheck.
If there's coffee in the pot, leave it. What about this house we bought? We don't need it. I'm gonna tell you something you're not gonna believe it. But I'm tired of this city, tired of this town, gonna leave it. What about all our friends? They won't miss us. How will it all end? A total with kisses. The black top and the wind, they're gonna fix us. And I'll be your man, mama, if you'll be my missus. I'm gonna change my name, hide my face. Everybody knows us in this place. You and me, mama, without a trace. But I'll hold the map, honey, if you still make like we were never here. You and me, mama, gonna disappear. Don't forget your coat, it might get cold. Grab all the letters I wrote, read them when we wrote. On the front door, leave a note that says it's so. Grab your dancing shoes, leave all the lies I've told. Don't forget the rings I bought for your hands. Bring a voice that sings. Exit dance. Leave behind things never stood a chance. Like your mother's good china and all our original plans. I'm gonna change my name, hide my face. Everybody knows us in this place. You and me, mama, without a trace. I'll hold the map, honey, if you still make like we were never here. You and me, mama, gonna disappear. you and me, mama, gonna disappear.
Parker Millsap and a song called Disappear. You'll find that on Parker's latest record, which is also called Parker Millsap. He was singing and playing the guitar, Daniel Foulkes playing the fiddle and doing backing vocals, Michael Rose playing the double bass. Parker Millsap, welcome to Soundcheck.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So Disappear, that's a song about getting out of Dodge, so to speak.
Right, or getting out of Purcell.
Well, now, you still live in Purcell, Oklahoma, right?
No, I actually moved to Guthrie, which is about an hour north.
Whoa. The big city.
Yeah, it's like Purcell's about 7,000 people, and Guthrie's like about 11,000. So. Uh-huh.
And what is there to do in Guthrie that drove you there?
Not a lot. It's just, it's pretty inexpensive to live there, and it's far enough away from my parents that, you know.
Now, you have a kind of well-weathered, almost leathery-sounding voice for someone so young. First of all, are you 21 yet?
I'll be 21 in 2 days.
All right. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
A voice that sounds like it's seen its share of whiskey and cigarettes on someone so young. And you can answer this question with a lie if you need to. You can see where
I'm going. I drink a lot of sriracha, just straight from the bottle.
Okay. presumably your early days setting up your career would have been a lot of playing in bars and places like that, right?
Well, we do a lot of that. I grew up in church, in a Pentecostal church, and there's a whole lot of loud singing, and I think that kind of, and you know, in Pentecostal churches, the preachers are very animated, and they do a lot of yelling, and you know, and that's like as much performance as it is, you know, sermon.
Yeah.
And I think that probably has something to do with it, you know.
Yeah. So the idea of storytelling, and speech as a kind of form of song. I mean, some of those preachers, they're practically singing, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and like the way they speak has an arc that's very musical.
Yeah. All right. Now, someone needs to explain to me what red dirt music is.
Uh-oh. It depends on who you ask. Yeah, I mean.
All right, I'm asking you, Parker Millsap. What is red dirt music?
To me, it's just a regional thing. You know, I guess if you come from Oklahoma or Texas and you play an acoustic guitar, you could be classified as red dirt music. Generally, red dirt is more rooted in songs than any other sort of, you know, shtick or anything like that. Generally more rooted in, like, well-written songs performed pretty simply, I think, is where it kind of started. It's kind of evolved into this big Texas thing lately, I think. But, you know, I wasn't around for most of it, so I can't really have an opinion about it.
From your description, I'm thinking, like, Towns Van Zandt or people like that?
Yeah, like, I think Towns, you know, like, they didn't call Towns Red Dirt. But like, I think.
But you know, people call you. They say
some people
playing.
Do. Some people say it's red dirt. Some people say it's not. I don't really care what they call it, as long as they buy the record.
All right, the record is called Parker Millsap by Parker Millsap with Michael Rose and Daniel Foulkes. They're all here in the studio today. What's happening in Truck Stop Gospel? This next song.
So Truck Stop Gospel is a song about a guy who in the South and the Midwest, maybe they have them around here too, I don't know. There are these things called truck stop churches where they take like the
here we have storefront churches, but
right. We have those too. We have strip mall churches in Oklahoma. But there are these truck stop churches. They take like the trailer part of an 18-wheeler and they gut it and they put like chairs and a little bitty stage at one end. And so like truckers, when they're on the road, they always
set up comfortable in the summer.
Yeah. And they have a, you know, a little church service in the trailer section. And so this is about a guy who gets inspired and, kind of becomes a Gideon of sorts. He really wants to give you a Bible.
All right, let's hear it.
All right.
The song is called Truck Stop Gospel. Once again, Parker Millsap singing and playing guitar, Michael Rose on bass, Daniel Folks playing the fiddle. Here they are live on Soundcheck.
Took them carry just me and Billy Graham and the Bibles that I carry. Me, I'm not just any other Dick or Harry. I got a big cross painted on the side of my rig to remind the devil that he ain't so big and scary. Crucifix hanging from my rearview mirror, the crown of thorns that helps me see things clearer. When I'm lost, the hands they help me steer. When I hit that rumble strip, I remember that the gospel ship is getting nearer. Well, the pile of the apostle preaching truck stop the gospel, I'm not hanging to hum. Just want you to love my Jesus. Gonna make you a true believer. Just want to modify your behavior. I just want you to love my Savior. Bibles on my tires. Holy water radiated. This truck ain't for hire. Gonna drive it till I join the angel choir. Tell anybody who will listen it. I've been saved. I'm a God-fearing Christian on fire. Parking lot lady wants me to let her climb in. So my kind of truck's the kind she could have a good time in. She jumped up, but before she could even climb in, well, I was speaking in the Holy Spirit. I cast that demon out, I could hear it dying. Well, the power of the apostle preaching truck stop the gospel. I'm not angry, I'm not lost. Just want you to love my Jesus. Gonna make you a true believer. Just want to modify your behavior. I just want you to love my Savior. Preaching truck stop gospel. I'm not angry, I'm not hostile. Just want you to love my Jesus. Gonna make you a true believer. Just want to modify your behavior. I just want you to love my Savior.
Parker Millsap and a song called Truck Stop Gospel, which appears on his latest record, also called Parker Millsap, with Michael Rose on bass and Daniel Folks on fiddle. Now, you've been singing these songs not just in Purcell in Guthrie, Oklahoma, but here in New York on a number of occasions.
Yeah, yeah.
Fair amount of time you've spent here.
Right.
Have you gotten comfortable in the big city yet?
I love New York City. I came here... I came here when I was in high school on like a band trip, like with a high school marching band.
Really? What did you play?
I played snare drum for like 7 years.
Sounds really.
And Michael, were you in the same band?
I wish.
Mike wasn't in band.
I would be 10 times the musician if I was.
So I came here on a band trip in high school, and basically we just like stared at you guys from a bus the whole time. You know, we did like the sightseeing tour, so I didn't really get to experience New York.
So what is your favorite, now that you've had a chance to experience at least some of New York, what is your favorite experience of the city been?
I just like all the different kinds. I like watching people because, you know, where we're from, like, it's mostly middle-aged white people who speak, you know, English. Really slow English, you know. And here, you know, there's just like there's somebody from everywhere, you know. That's on true. Every block. And something I really enjoy, and I know the guys do as well, is all the different kinds of food. Like, you can get a really good version of any kind of food within like 3 blocks here.
That's right, absolutely.
You don't got to drive all the way to Oklahoma City to get sushi, you know.
Yeah. What about the other side of the New York experience?
We haven't parking is like traffic and parking we're not used to in Oklahoma. There's no real traffic to speak of, and you
being
don't
honked at.
Yeah, people only use their horns in Oklahoma if like they want you to die, you know. Like, you know, and here it's, you know, it's just, hey, look out, you know.
But you learned earlier today that once you find a parking spot,
yeah, you stay there.
You stay there. You stay there until you're ready to leave town.
Exactly.
Well, Parker, Michael, Daniel, guys, thanks for coming in and playing for us today.
Oh,
it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
Trumpet sound and the ground starts humming. There ain't no use hiding or running.
If you enjoyed our session with Parker Millsap, there's more conversation and music on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next, Jennifer Ringer recently gave her final performance as principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. She joins us for a look back at the breathtaking and high-pressure world of dance, next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. When you spend 24 years dancing with the New York City Ballet, you'll see plenty of ups and downs. And I don't just mean when you soar through the air or are tossed by another dancer. In her new memoir, Jennifer Ringer writes about some very different ups and downs during her years as first a soloist and then principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. Her book is called Dancing Through It, My Journey in the Ballet. Jennifer Ringer, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
The journey, I mean, this is like an odyssey. This is like something out of Homer. It's an epic tale of, you know, early success, struggles with body image, the sugar plum gate, which we have to get to. But it all starts with a single piece of music and dance, the Serenade for Strings by Tchaikovsky, the Serenade by Balanchine. You start with that in the book. Why?
Serenade was the first ballet that really convinced me that I wanted to dance for a living. I had been one of those little girls that danced in her room. I was a big fan of ABBA, and I turned that music on and danced in my room to my heart's content. But it was always an after-school activity. It was a hobby. But when I was, I think I was 13, I got the opportunity to dance with a professional company in Washington, D.C., doing George Balanchine's Serenade. And it was the experience of performing that ballet that, you know, the steps felt like they were visible representations of the music. And having that experience on stage with the lighting and the costume, It was that made me want to be a dancer for a living.
And the music, was it played from a recording, or did you have the experience of dancing to live music?
No, we had an orchestra, which is so
after
different.
The same ABBA song, afternoon after afternoon in the bedroom.
Exactly. Having a live orchestra and having the different phrasing and just that feeling of having the live musicians kind of buoying you up into the dance was incredible.
This is the music that first buoyed Jennifer Ringer into her journey through ballet. The piece is Serenade by Balanchine, set to this music by Tchaikovsky. Little bit of Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings in C, which is the basis for the George Balanchine dance called Serenade, a turning point in the life of Jennifer Ringer, the former principal dancer of the New York City Ballet and author of the new memoir, Dancing Through It, My Journey in the Ballet. Jennifer, a lot of the book deals with your struggle with body image. Mm-hmm. You grew up in South Carolina, right?
Yes.
Was that horse country by any chance?
No, I was in the coastal South.
Okay,
because I grew up.
Reading a lot of what you talk about, eating and anorexia and mm-hmm. over exercising to compensate for mm-hmm. the eating, I just kept thinking of jockeys.
Oh, yeah.
Thoroughbred jockeys who have the same. Not that it's an image problem, but it's part of the fabric of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Did that come before you began, to realize that dance would be your profession, your life?
No, I never had problems with body image or anything like that, really, until after I was in the professional world. I became a professional dancer when I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was going through teenage years anyway, so I don't know what was exacerbated by the fact that I was a teenager. But my body image problems, didn't start until maybe I was around 18.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I started developing eating disorders and really struggling with a lot of that.
Is that common in the dance world?
I think it is, in the fact that it's also just kind of a common thing in the world. I mean, mm-hmm. I feel like, and it's funny because it's National Eating Disorders Week this week, actually. I think it's a thing that so many, particularly teenage girls, struggle with. And then I do think it just becomes more of a focus when you're in a profession where your body is your instrument. And I think, a lot of those things, like, probably gymnastics, anything where, there's been so much about models struggling with
right.
this kind of thing.
But, we've seen in the world of modern dance, especially in recent years, mm-hmm. Dance troupes with all kinds of body types.
Mm-hmm. I think traditionally that there is the thought that a ballerina has to look a particular way. And of course, dancers do have to be very fit, and they have to be honed and, ready for the demands of the life. And also we dance all day. Sometimes it's 10 to 12 hours of physical exertion that we're doing. So a lot of times thinness is a result of all of that. the reality is, though, is that there really is every body type out there. And what's beautiful about dance and what's beautiful about ballet in general is just seeing these beautiful bodies moving to this beautiful music. But I think that the stereotype still exists that a ballerina needs to look a certain way.
Well, now, let me just get a little bit of kind of practical stuff out of the way. The different levels of dancer within it. I mean, you join as an apprentice.
Yes.
And then at some point you became a soloist.
Yes, and actually there's a, after being an apprentice, we get into the corps de ballet.
The corps de ballet, yes. Right. What is the difference between a soloist and a principal? Because both seem to be doing, you know, solo roles.
Yes, the soloist, soloists can do kind of demi roles, just slightly more featured than the corps de ballet. And they can also do the principal roles where they're the absolute featured person. A principal dancer really only does the absolute featured roles.
Okay, so the Sugar Plum Fairy, for example, would be...
Would be a principal dancer. It could be also a soloist, but a soloist might also be, say, the lead Hot Chocolate.
Right.
Whereas a principal dancer would no longer be doing the lead Hot Chocolate.
Got it. Now, you write it at one point, 1997, the New York City Ballet actually did not renew your contract and let you go. That was during the whole time that you were struggling with this body image thing.
Yes. I went through a couple of years of eating disorders and struggling with the self-esteem and all that stuff. And so I was kind of gaining weight regularly. I did go through a period where I was anorexic and I just was too thin, but then it changed into something else. So I was slowly gaining weight. And the company, they really actually gave me a long grace period. Until finally they just had to let me go. They weren't able to use me.
Where were you in that hierarchy at that point?
I was a soloist.
You were a soloist. And what was your the book is, you know, my journey in the ballet. What was your journey back into ballet at that point?
Well, at that point, you know, it was devastating to no longer have a job as a dancer. And I really did quit. In my head, I quit completely. And I took other jobs. I was a secretary for a while, and I taught aerobics.
Went back to school.
Oh yeah, I finished my education at Fordham University, and in the long run, though, it was the best thing that could have possibly happened to me was to get kind of kicked out of the ballet world because it forced me to confront all of my issues. And as I became healthier, I was able to kind of return to dance and find my love for it, you know, discover kind of that little girl that was dancing to ABBA in her bedroom again and go back into it. And I, you know, I was able to approach the company and ask them if they would be willing to take me back, and they did.
We're speaking with Jennifer Ringer, former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet, which she joined back in 1989 as an apprentice. You were 16.
Yep.
Became a soloist in 95. You became principal dancer in 2000. Again, all of this is in Jennifer's book, Dancing Through It, My Journey in the Ballet. And so you become principal dancer. It seems like all of this is behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2010, it rears its ugly head again in a most unexpected way. Give us the condensed Reader's Digest version, if you could, of Sugar Plum Gate.
Well, basically, I danced the role of the Sugar Plum Fairy for opening night Nutcracker. And the reviewer, a review came out where he said that it looked like I had had one sugar plum too many. So he basically said it looked like I was heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the hoopla happened when a whole bunch of people who knew about my past. And there was
Did the reviewer... As far as you know?
I don't know, actually. I don't know about that. But there was a great outcry in my defense, and it ended up becoming kind of a big deal, and it opened up a big discussion in the ballet world about, you know, dance criticism and weight in the ballet and all that stuff.
But more importantly, it opened that discussion outside the ballet world.
Yes.
And you found yourself on Oprah and the Today Show and all that kind of stuff. So this became... a real kind of cause celeb in the country for, you know, a couple of days at least.
Yeah, no, I think it was actually a really good thing that it happened. You know, it was actually a good moment for me in my life because to be publicly criticized for my weight, and then to realize I was okay with that was for me a big triumph. To realize that I had kind of left all that stuff behind, and then I also just think it was a healthy discussion in general for people to have.
Right, and it was coming at the time that film, Black Swan, was had brought ballet into the sort of common, you know, cultural conversation for a change.
Yes, and so there was already a great deal of public interest in the ballet world in general, yes.
What, you've seen Black Swan.
Yes.
What did you think of it?
You know, I thought I thought the first half was a pretty accurate depiction of the pressures that are in the ballet world and of the psychological journey that dancers sometimes go through. And, you know, the last half was a thriller. I mean, there's very few ballerinas that I've killed and stuffed into my dressing room. But it was a thriller. It turned to, you know, some craziness happens.
And yet, now we learn that sometimes craziness does happen in the ballet world. That the business in the Bolshoi, you know, with throwing acid on the director's face and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, have you seen anything like that?
No, that was horrifying. Yeah.
But, of course, that was, you know, in Russia, ballet is like baseball to us.
Right,
you know,
it's a
national pastime.
Yes, yes.
Speaking with Jennifer Ringer, she is former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. Her book is Dancing Through It, My Journey in the Ballet. And, you know, as we've said, it takes you outside the often very insular world of ballet at various points in your career to, you know, big conversations that involve many people in the country. Your final performance was on February 9th.
Yes.
And it was a dance called Dances at a Gathering. Jerome Robbins did this choreography. Dancers don't usually get to pick their programs, right? Did you have a hand in this?
You know, when I was speaking with my boss, Peter Martins, about my last show, there was already the program had been picked, and there was that one performance in February that was Dances at a Gathering. And this is a ballet that has just been important to me for really 24 years. I've danced at my various parts in it my whole career. And I thought it would just be so special if I could end with that one. And so I asked him if that was possible, and he said it was okay.
So in the beginning of your career, you would have been in the corps de ballet. At some point, you would have done some of the solo roles, the supporting actress roles, I guess.
Yes, it's one of those. It's actually a very small ballet. It only has 10 dancers. But in the beginning, I did a role that was kind of meant for a younger, sprightly, energetic girl. And then when I was no longer sprightly and energetic, I moved on to a more mature role. And then there's a third part that I got to do at the end. So,
and the piece, Dances at a Gathering, is set to various works by Chopin, waltzes, mazurkas, and stuff. And it, too, will change every night depending on who the pianist is. And even if it's the same pianist, it might change somewhat from night to night, right?
Yes, that's one of the reasons why I love the ballet, because it feels like a family. It's only got the 10 dancers, and then there's this 11th member of the family, which is the pianist. And, you know, we just have to respond to the phrasing of the pianist, and it's almost like a dialogue between the dancers and the musician. And there's so many times where we actually have to make eye contact with the pianist before she will play her note as we take our step. And it's a really special relationship.
So it's not that it's improvisatory, but there is an element of, you know, it won't be exactly the same night from night.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, we had this beautiful pianist, Susan Walters, that, you know, she will phrase things according to how she feels them at the time. And so we learn to respond to that. And she might even take a cue from how we, you know, whether we have a wild look in our eye when we step on stage or, you know, so it really is it's a back and forth.
Well, this is some of the music that Jennifer Ringer danced to at her final performance from Jerome Robbins' Dances at a Gathering. This is the Chopin Waltz in A minor. Thank you. That is Garrick Olson's version of Chopin's Waltz in A Minor, Opus 34, Number 2, one of the collection of Chopin works that makes up the Jerome Robbins piece Dances at a Gathering, which was the final performance by Jennifer Ringer, former principal dancer at the New York City Ballet and author of the book Dancing Through It, My Journey in the Ballet. That was your final performance. It's not like you've stopped dancing. I mean, you talk about having a second kid and getting back into shape and all that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
You know, have you?
I don't have plans to perform again.
No, but I mean, you look like, I mean, we were talking about body image before. You look like you're still in shape and you could probably get out there and do it if you need
to. Well, it might hurt something, but, you know, I do love to dance. I will always love to dance. And I do, you know, I'd love to keep taking classes or, you know, I kind of am thinking about maybe taking tap or tango or maybe something a little different from ballet. Hmm. But I don't think I'll perform anymore.
Well, now, there's much more in the book about family and faith. Your husband, James Fayette, also a dancer. And you guys are moving to L.A., is that right?
Yes, we are.
You're leaving us after
I know.
All these years?
I know.
After everything we've done for you?
Seriously. You know, I love New York. I'm going to grieve for New York City. I really have loved living here. But yes, we got offered jobs out in Los Angeles, and we're going to be starting a new school program. It's going to be called the Colburn Dance Academy. And we're going to be training young pre-professional dancers and also hopefully incorporating the other arts in with it. The school is within a music conservatory, so we're hoping to give them a more complete artistic education. So it's something that we're really excited about.
So still in the world of dance.
Yes.
Just bringing up the next generation.
Yes.
Jennifer Ringer's book is called Dancing Through It, My Journey in the Ballet. It is a pretty remarkable journey, and Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on the show, a look back at Free to Be You and Me, the children's book, album, and TV show that shaped a generation of kids and their parents during the 1970s. We'll talk with some of the people involved in creating Free to Be You and Me, including former NFL star Rosie Grier, who famously sang the song It's All Right to Cry. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.